Hello, it's Scott Manley here. Earlier in the week, over on the East Coast, there was a launch out of Wallops. It was called That's Not a Knife, which, of course, I should have said in an Australian accent, because everyone knows the next line to follow that is, that's a hypersonic scramjet. Wait, what? No, yeah, this was actually Rocket Lab performing one of their HASTE launches, right? Which is a hypersonic test platform where they use the first stage and possibly second stage of an Electron to carry payloads into high trajectories so that they can test hypersonic hardware. And in this case, it was an Australian-built aircraft called the Dart AE. It was a largely 3D-printed structure with a scramjet that was supposed to power it. Now, we know that it was hydrogen-fueled, we know it was 3D-printed, we know that it was in collaboration with the US Defense Innovation Unit, it was called a Cassowary Vex, and we know that it was supposed to fly in speeds of excess of Mach 7. And that's really about it. We don't know what happened next. But scramjets, that's what I'm here to talk about. Yes, a lot of you, if you follow spaceflight and rocket science and stuff, you've probably heard of what a scramjet is, right? You might even know that scramjet is short for supersonic combustion ramjet. But what do they do? Why do we need to have scramjets when other jet types exist? So let's talk about this. So regular jet engines, as you probably know, they have a set of compressors at the front. They suck in air through the intake. The compressors are spinning. They compress the air down to make higher pressure air. Then you inject fuel and burn it. And then you let that fuel, that exhaust gas expand over a turbine, which in turn drives the compressors. But more importantly, the gas that expands out the back gives you your thrust, gives you your propulsion. Now, this is great. This is a highly versatile engine. You can also stick a propeller on the front and get a turboprop. You can add a big fan disc on the front and have a turbo fan, which gives you better fuel efficiency for those big airliners. Or you can have an afterburner at the back and forget about the high bypass part and get high performance, super fast military jet fighters. This is a sort of aircraft engine that basically underpins almost all modern aviation, right? But the speed limits on this is that as you start to go faster and faster, the air that comes in is getting hotter, right? Because you've got a certain amount of kinetic energy as the air comes in and is slowed down. That converts some of its velocity into heat. Some of it's converted into pressure, but some of it's converted into heat. And that extra heat, when combined with the fuel being burned, means that the temperature that is escaping the burners and going over those turbines, it can start to get too hot, so to the point where the turbine inlet temperature is too hot for the hardware and your jet engine can't fly any faster without potentially destroying it. Now, as I said, as the aircraft is flying through the air, it is scooping up air and that air is flowing in. And it's quite common to shape the way the air intake is to actually help it get a little bit of compression from that air. If you look at a regular jet airliner, you'll notice that these big circular intakes at the front, they actually expand outwards. If you know Bernoulli's theorem, you'll know that as a flow through a pipe expands, then the velocity has to slow down. And as the velocity slows down, the pressure increases. Therefore, the intakes on regular jet engines and nacelles is designed so that you get free compression from flying forwards. And the jet intakes that we see, like with where you have like a ramp intake or a shot cone intake, on fighters and other high performance jet, those are also designed to get some extra compression from the airflow. And so if you go fast enough, you can just get rid of that compressor system. You can get rid of those turbines and you can have the air being entirely compressed by the airflow into it. It then goes subsonic, it gets slowed down so that it can then burn in the combustion section and then expand out the back and generate net thrust. That is a jet engine where the pressure is being created by ram pressure, hence ram jet. And ram jets are great. You know, those have been demonstrated in a bunch of missile systems, even the SR-71, like it would switch into like a ramjet mode towards the higher end. But the problem with ramjets is they sort of tend to max out around Mach 5. As you bring the air in, what you're trying to do is take its velocity and convert it to pressure. But what happens is as you get really fast, you have this like what's called a normal shock. So this is like a flat shock that is normal to the airflow. That's the only way the air can really go from supersonic to subsonic. And the bigger that jump, the less pressure recovery you get. The more of that excess velocity is converted into heat rather than into pressure, and you want pressure. So the air that flows into the combustor section gets hotter. And then when you burn more stuff, you start to hit problems like the materials of your jet being subject to heating, which is beyond the capabilities. But other than that, because you're losing efficiency in the compression, you then have to, you don't get as much power out the back. You don't get as much thrust out the back. And so you tend to max out around Mach 5, where you simply can't get enough thrust to overcome the losses due to the pressure. In ramjets, there's another high temperature problem. Even if you have the walls that are cooled perfectly so they can handle ridiculous amounts of heat, what happens is as the air gets so hot, it starts breaking down. And so your combustion doesn't happen inside the combustor because there's so much heat in here that the chemicals keep breaking down and reforming, and you end up losing energy and therefore losing thrust. And that's another reason why you can't get a ramjet to work past about Mach 5 reliably. So, a scramjet is the next step up, and the whole idea is that you want supersonic combustion. If you can get rid of that section with the normal shock where you're slowing the air down, you can have various shock shaping and stuff to recover energy and convert it to pressure, but you just can't slow it down to subsonic speeds. And that means that the air is flowing through that combustor section at supersonic speeds, hence supersonic combustion. So scramjets, I guess they sort of start out around high Mach 4, Mach 5, and they can go all the way up to at least Mach 10. They might be able to go up to Mach 12 even. We're not sure just how fast you can go with a scramjet before it becomes just as efficient to use a regular rocket engine with onboard oxidizer. So there's been a fair amount of history in the development of these things. They were known around about since the 1960s, but most of the testing occurred in like ground-based tests hardware, you know, shock tunnels to generate the high Mach numbers to blow into them and verify that the design worked. The first actual test flights, I think, really started in the 1990s, and it was actually a Russian engine that was flown on a rocket. This was an axially symmetric engine which was burning hydrogen. Now, it flew up like a sounding rocket and it came down. It only burned for a few seconds. What they wanted to demonstrate was that they could, in fact, light the fire inside this engine and have the burn be sustained. They didn't really care about generating thrust. They wanted to just make sure that they could actually make this engine light and keep it lit. Now, later on, this series of tests, they would actually start collaborating with the US and France. They did a bunch of different flights on SA-5 missiles. These reached speeds of like up to Mach 6.5. They operated for 77 seconds at one point, which was great, although they didn't really have any net thrust, apparently. But eventually, yeah, they demonstrated the basics and other people went off and did other things. Australia, for example. Interestingly enough, Australia actually has a lot of research in scramjets down in the University of Queensland. They flew HyShot 2 in 2002. This was another hydrogen-fueled ramjet. They showed that they could sustain flame and they showed that they could actually generate thrust. Incidentally, the early tests tend to use hydrogen because it's much better at cooling, but also it's much easier to light, much easier to flow in through the injectors. So the early engines use hydrogen. Once the groups tend to get experience, they tend to switch over to hydrocarbon fuels like jet fuel. So around early 2000s, you also have the X-43A Hyper-X. This is a unpiloted, hydrogen-fueled, airframe-integrated scramjet. And this was launched from a B-52 on the nose of a Pegasus rocket. It was accelerated up to a speed of Mach 6.8 at 95,000 feet, whereupon its engine lit out. Fired its engine for about 10 to 11 seconds. It actually demonstrated acceleration in this regime. And then after that, it shut down and it still continued to fly for about 10 minutes before ditching into the ocean. And then a little later in November of 2024, they boosted another vehicle, similar design, obviously modified for slightly higher speeds, up to a speed of Mach 9.6, 7,000 miles per hour. This is the Guinness World Record for an air-breathing jet engine. And so in this conditions, they were able to light the engine, they were able to demonstrate thrust, they were able to make it sustain against the drag in this Mach 10 regime. After the engine shut down, again, it flew for a while and then continued to a controlled descent into the ocean. So there was a few other other tests after this. 2005, we start to see a US test of a JP-10, right? You know, jet-fueled thing flying from Wallops. So that's not a knife. That's not the first launch out of Wallops carrying a scramjet. In 2012, Australia and the US Air Force Labs launched a Highfire. And these were actually some of the first ones to demonstrate transition through different speed zones, going from like Mach 6 up to Mach 8, and switching between different engine firing modes to sustain the combustion. These were launched on sounding rockets that went up like almost 300 kilometers and then came down, and as they come down, they have a few seconds of operation to verify, like some like 8 seconds of operation. And then 2010, we get the X-51A Waverider, and this was a US Air Force mission. So this was launched again from a B-52, and it used an Atacams solid rocket fuel motor, right? You know, the one that's used for these surface-to-surface missiles that Army uses. This one, it burned JP-7, which is the same special high-performance fuel that was used on the SR-71. So the first one of this, it ran in 2010 for 200 seconds. So this was not just a one and done. This was a sustained operation at like a Mach 5. That was the longest flight. Then later on, they flew it again for 210 seconds, during which it covered 230 nautical miles. That's over a mile a second at hypersonic speeds. And more recently, DARPA and the US Air Force have been testing the hypersonic air-breathing weapon concept. That's like Raytheon, Northrop Grumman, Lockheed Martin, Aerojet Rocketdyne. Again, this is a scramjet-powered cruise missile that's supposed to operate at Mach 5. So now, coming back to the design of hypersonic scramjets, right? Really, a huge part of this is the shape of the entire intake and structure, because this thing is moving through the air and all the work has to be done by the geometry. They have to generate these oblique shocks in the right place to try to recover as much pressure as possible and compress the air before the combustion section. Then you somehow need to keep a flame lit while moving at supersonic speeds. If you've ever blown out a candle, you'll understand that fast-moving air tends to blow out flames, right? The flame doesn't move at supersonic speeds. That is a big part of that. And then, of course, you have to have a whole combustion section, mixing section, because the air doesn't spend very much time inside these nozzles. Since it's already moving at, like, potentially Mach 10, the air could spend milliseconds inside this nozzle, during which you ideally want to have complete combustion. In a rocket engine, you have a combustion chamber, and the rocket engine combustion chamber has to be long enough to achieve complete combustion. Otherwise, you're essentially throwing uncombusted products out the back. The same is true in a hypersonic scramjet, except that the speeds are so much faster. Therefore, you need to achieve insane levels of mixing and combustion efficiency. So a lot of attention is paid to the way the fuel is injected into the system. And there's a lot of different ideas on how to do this efficiently. But what you will see is various like step or ramp style structures. And these are designed to create recirculation zones, right? So you have the air moving along and then it hits a discontinuity and it creates a little vortex in there. And these vortices are designed in such a way that they will trap a flame. So the flame is moving in this area, sustaining for long enough that it can keep that heat and pass it on into the fuel flow to keep the engine lit during these speeds. But you don't want these things to be too big, because then, of course, then they end up slowing the air in general. So there's a balance in this design. Other ideas is you have posts that run through or struts, and these struts can be like a triangle shape with a wide back, and the fuel gets injected there, and again you create the same sort of eddies downrange from it, which traps the flame and then hopefully provides a fair amount of mixing before the fuel goes downstream. There's various other strut designs. Like if you have scramjets which are essentially, you know, axially symmetric, then you need to have various struts to support the inside and the outside. And so it's natural, if you have that, to try to make sure that you put your fuel injectors in this area, because you need to have something sticking out that way anyway. You will typically have multiple areas within the engine where you are injecting the fuel, because you want to make sure that the combustion is going on at a consistent rate. And then of course, if you want your combustion to happen completely and efficiently, you need to make sure that the air that is coming in is being very quickly mixed with the fuel. Now, mixing generally involves some sort of turbulent flow so that you've got a very microscopic scale, you know, mixing. But of course, turbulence robs your airflow of energy and creates heat. So you really want to try and minimize that. So there's a lot of research that has to go into making sure that you're mixing your fuel efficiently without losing any performance out the back. Then of course, the air flows out the back. Now, the performance of scramjets, they typically get performance that is better than rocket engines, at least in the lower speed regime. You can start out with the performance of maybe like 4,000 seconds for impulse. And if you're not a rocket guy, that's about 10 times better than your average rocket engine, right? But as you go faster and faster, the amount of performance you're able to recover from that intake air and out the back starts to drop. And depending upon the combustion efficiency, it will typically drop to the point where a regular rocket engine starts to be better around Mach 10 to Mach 12. So another thing you'll see from a lot of scramjet concepts is that the design of the airframe is kind of integrated into the design of the air intake. You'll frequently see that these, instead of having a pointy nose, they have a wide, long nose. And this is essentially part of a ramp intake, where the ramp is the shape, right? It's not a ram, it's a ramp intake, where it generates a shockwave, an oblique shockwave, which serves to slow the air down a little, recover some of its pressure without heating it as much as possible. And then you'll have an intake on the bottom, which will generate its own shockwaves. And these shockwaves are oblique, they're going at an angle. They're intended to recover the pressure as much as possible without heating the air, without slowing it down to subsonic speeds, but really getting some sort of compression where possible. And of course, as these jets move through multiple speed regimes, the position where these shockwaves are is going to change. So you will find that these well-designed intake is going to have a lot of geometry changes to accommodate this range of speeds. Most of the scramjets really have only been optimized for one speed or another, but if you wanted to make something that worked consistently, it's going to have to change this geometry. We also see like variable geometry intakes in regular aircraft, by the way. If you ever look at them, the intakes on modern jet fighters, you'll actually see that they have mechanical parts that open and close. For example, I highlighted the MiG-29. It has these ramp intakes, which actually close down completely on the ground. Well, those actually adjust their position to adjust the airflow. Same is true if you're operating in the hypersonics regime. So like ramjets, yeah, they're definitely easier to build because it's much easier to just slow the air down and sustain combustion in that regime. The real trick with the scramjets is figuring out how to slow the air without slowing it down too much, recover as much pressure as possible, then to sustain the flame in this kind of airflow, make sure the fuel mixture is mixed sufficiently that you burn very quickly in the few milliseconds the air is inside the engine, and then let that fully combusted fuel expand out the back, and then, yeah, you can accelerate all your way up to Mach 10 and then perhaps switch over to rocket engines to get yourself on the way to orbit. This would be the sci-fi dream, right? The aircraft that takes off on turbines, switches over to ramjets, switches over to scramjets, and then maybe at the end switches over to rocket engines. Single stage to orbit. That's the dream we all want. I'm Scott Manley. Fly safe.